Cigarettes, ersatz love charms, knotted drawings of women undressing, and scrolls painted with lurid sunsets, overladen with one-line inspirational slogans. Lurleen lives on within each heart. Safe keep the wizard's laws, and the wizard's laws will keep you safe. I pray to the unnamed god that justice will walk abroad in Oz. Bach noted the variety. The pagan, the authoritarian, and the old-fashioned unionist impulses. But nothing directly sympathetic to the royalists, who had gone underground in the 16 harsh years since the wizard had first wrested power from the Ozma regent. The Ozma line had been Gilliknees originally, and surely there were active pockets of resistance to the wizard. But Gilliken had, in fact, thrived under the wizard, so the royalists kept mum. Besides, everyone had heard the rumors of strict court action against turncoats and peristrophists. Bach bought a broadsheet published out of the Emerald City, several weeks old, but it was the first he'd seen in some time, and he settled down at a café. He read about the Emerald City Home Guard suppressing some animal dissenters who were making a nuisance of themselves in the palace gardens. He looked for news of the provinces, and found a filler about Munchkinland, which continued experiencing near-drought conditions. Occasional thunderbursts would drench the ground, but the water would run off or sink uselessly into the clay. They said that hidden subterranean lakes underlay the Vincus region, that water resources there could serve the whole of Oz. But the idea of a canal system across the entire country made everyone laugh. The expense! There was great disagreement between the eminences and the Emerald City as to what was to be done. Secession, thought Bach seditiously, and looked up to see Elphaba alone, without even a nanny or Amma, standing over him. "What a delicious expression you have on your face, Bach," she said. "It's much more interesting than love." "It is love, in a way," said Bach, then remembered himself and leaped to his feet. "Won't you join me? Please take a seat, unless you're worried about being unchaperoned." She sat down, looking a bit etiolated, and allowed him to call for a cup of mineral tea. She had a parcel in brown paper and string under her arm. "A few trinkets for my sister," she said. "She's like Miss Galinda. She loves the fancy outside of things. I found a Vincus shawl in the bazaar, red roses on a black background, with black and green fringe. I'm sending it to her. And a pair of striped stockings that Amma Clutch knitted for me." "I didn't know you had a sister," he said. "Was she in the playgroup we were in together?" "She's 3 years younger," Elphaba said. "She'll come to Craige Hall before long." "Is she as difficult as you are?" "She's difficult in a different way. She's crippled pretty severely, is my Nessa Rose, so she's a handful. Even Madame Morrible doesn't quite know the extent of it. But by then I'll be a third-year girl, and will have the nerve to stand up to the head, I guess. If anything gives me nerve, it's people making life hard for Nessa Rose. Life is already hard enough for her." "Is your mama raising her?" "My mother is dead. My father is in charge. Nominally." "Nominally?" "He's religious," said Elphaba, and made the circling palms gesture that indicated you could grind millstone against millstone all you liked, but there wasn't any quern in the land that could produce flour if there was no grain to grind. "It sounds very hard for you all. How did your mama die?" "She died in childbirth, and this is the end of the personal interview. Tell me about Dr. Dillamond. I hear you're working for him. Tell me about your amusing campaign for the heart of Galinda the Ice Queen." Bach really wanted to hear about Dr. Dillamond, but was derailed by Elphaba's remark. "I will keep on, Elfie, I will. When I see her, I'm so smitten with longing, it's like fire in my veins. I can't speak, and the things I think about are like visions. It's like dreaming. It's like floating in your dreams. I don't dream. Tell me, is there any hope? What does she say? Does she ever even imagine that her feelings for me might change? Elphaba sat with her two elbows on the table, her hands clasped in front of her face, her two forefingers leaning against each other and against her thin grayish lips. "You know, Bach," she said, "the thing is, I have become fond of Galinda myself. Behind her starry-eyed love of herself, there is a mind struggling to work. She does think about things. When her mind is really working, she could, if led, think on you. Even, I suspect, somewhat fondly. I suspect. I don't know. But when she slides back into herself, I mean into the girl who spends 2 hours a day curling that beautiful hair, it's as if the thinking Galinda goes into some internal closet and shuts the door. Or as if she's in hysterical retreat from things that are too big for her. I love her both ways, but I find it odd. I wouldn't mind leaving myself behind if I could, but I don't know the way out. I propose you're being hard on her. And you're certainly too forward," said Bach sternly. "Were she sitting here, I think she'd be astounded to hear you speak so freely." "I'm just trying to behave as I think a friend should behave. Granted, I haven't had much practice." "Well, I question your friendship with me, if you consider Miss Galinda your friend, too, and if that's how you tear a friend apart in her absence." Though Bach was irritated, he had found that this was a more lively discussion than the conventional patter he and Galinda had so far exchanged. He didn't want to burn Elphaba off with criticism. "I'm ordering you another mineral tea," he said, in an authoritative voice, his father's voice, in fact, "and then you can tell me about Dr. Dillamond." "Skip the tea. I'm still nursing this one, and you have no more money than I do, I bet," said Elphaba. "But I'll tell you about Dr. Dillamond, unless you are too affronted at the slice and angle of my opinions." "Please, perhaps I am wrong," said Bach. "Look, it's a nice day. We're both off the campus. How do you come to be out alone, by the way? Is your escape sanctioned by Madame Morrible?" "Take a guess about that," she said, grinning. "Once it was clear that you could come and go from Craig Hall by way of the vegetable garden and the roof of the adjacent stable, I decided I could, too. I'm never missed." "That's hard for me to believe," said he, daringly, "for you're not the kind who blends into the woodwork. Now tell me about Dr. Dillamond. He's my idol." She sighed and set the package down on the table at last, and settled in for a long chat. She told him about Dr. Dillamond's work in natural essences, trying to determine by scientific method what the real differences were between animal and animal tissue, between animal and human tissue. The literature on the matter, she had learned from doing the legwork herself, was all couched in unionist terms and pagan terms before that, and they didn't hold up to scientific scrutiny. "Don't forget, Shiz University was originally a unionist monastery," said Elphaba. "So despite the anything-goes attitude among the educated elite, there are still bedrocks of unionist bias." "But I am a unionist," said Bach, "and I don't see the conflict. The unnamed God is accommodating to many ranges of being, not just human." "Are you talking about a subtle bias against animals, interwoven into early unionist tracts, and still in operation today?" "That's certainly what Dr. Dillamond thinks. And he's a unionist himself. Explain that paradox, and I'd be glad to convert. I admire the goat intensely, but the real interest of it to me is the political slant. if he can isolate some bit of the biological architecture to prove that there isn't any difference. Deep down in the invisible pockets of human and animal flesh, that there's no difference between us, or even among us, if you take in animal flesh too. Well, you see the implications. No, said Bok, I don't think I do. How can the bans on animal mobility be upheld if Dr. Dillamond can prove scientifically that there isn't any inherent difference between humans and animals? Oh, now that's a blueprint for an impossibly rosy future, said Bok. Think about it, said Elphaba. Think, Bok. On what grounds could the wizard possibly continue to publish those bans? How could he be persuaded not to? The wizard has dissolved the Hall of Approval indefinitely. I don't believe, Elfie, that the wizard is open to entertaining arguments, even by as august an animal as Dr. Dillamond. But of course he must be. He's a man in power. It's his job to consider changes in knowledge. When Dr. Dillamond has his proof, he'll write to the wizard and begin to lobby for change. No doubt he'll do his best to let animals the land over know what he's intending, too. He isn't a fool. Well, I didn't say he was a fool, said Bok. But how close do you think he is to getting firm evidence? I am a student handmaid, said Elphaba. I don't even understand what he means. I'm only a secretary, an amanuensis. You know he can't write things himself. He can't manage a pen with his hoofs. I take dictation, and I file, and I dash to the Craige Hall Library and look things up. Briscoe Hall Library would be a better place to hunt for that kind of material, said Bok. Even Three Queens, where I work this summer, has stacks of documents from the monks' observations of animal and vegetable life. I know I am not traditionally presented, said Elphaba, but I believe on the grounds of being a girl, I am excluded from the Briscoe Hall Library. And on the grounds of being an animal, so too, now at least, is Dr. Dillamond. So those valuable resources are off-limits to us. Well, said Bok carelessly, if you knew exactly what you wanted, I have access to the stacks in both collections. And when the good doctor is finished ferreting out the difference between animals and people, I will propose he apply the same arguments to the differences between the sexes, said Elphaba. Then she registered what Bok had said, and stretched out her hand, almost as if to touch him. Oh, Bok, Bok, on behalf of Dr. Dillamond, I accept your generous offer of help. I'll get the first list of sources to you within the week. Just leave my name out of it. I don't care so much about incurring horrible Morrible's wrath against myself, but I don't want her taking out her annoyance on my sister, Nessa Rose. She downed the last of her tea, gathered her parcel, and had sprung up almost before Bok could pull himself to his feet. Various customers, lingering over their elevenses with their own broadsheets or novellas, looked up at the ungainly girl pushing out the doors. As Bok settled back down, hardly yet registering what he had gotten himself into, he realized, slowly but thoroughly, that this morning there were no animals taking their morning tea in here. No animals at all. In years to come, and Bok would live a long life, he would remember the rest of the summer as scented with the must of old books, when ancient script swam before his eyes. He sleuthed alone in the musty stacks. He hovered over the mahogany drawers lined with vellum manuscripts. All season long, it seemed, the lozenge-paned windows between bluestone mullions and transoms misted over again and again with flecks of small but steady rain, almost as brittle and pesky as sand. Apparently the rain never made it as far as Munchkin Land, but Bok tried not to think about that. Crope and Tibbet were coerced into researching for Dr. Delamont, too. At first, they had to be dissuaded from going about their forays in costumes of disguise, fake pince-nez, powdered wigs, cloaks with high collars, all to be found in the well-stocked locker of the Three Queens Student Theatrical and Terpsichorean Society. But when convinced of the seriousness of the mission, they fell to with gusto. Once a week, they met Bach and Elphaba in the café in Railway Square. Elphaba showed up, during these misty weeks, entirely swathed in a brown cloak with a hood and veil that hid all but her eyes. She wore long, frayed grey gloves that she boasted buying second-hand from a local undertaker, cheap for having been used in funeral services. She sheathed her bamboo pole legs in a double thickness of cotton stocking. The first time Bach saw Elphaba like this, he said, "I just barely managed to convince Crope and Tibbet to lose the espionage drag, and you come in looking like the original Cumbric witch." "I don't dress for your approval, boys," she said, shucking her cloak and folding it inside out so that the wet wool never touched her. On the occasion when another café patron would come through, shaking water off an umbrella, Elphaba always recoiled, flinching if she was caught by even a scattering of drops. "Is that religious conviction, Elfie, that you keep yourself so dry?" said Bach. "I've told you before, I don't comprehend religion, although conviction is a concept I'm beginning to get. In any case, someone with a real religious conviction is, I propose, a religious convict, and deserves locking up." "Hence," observed Crope, "your aversion to all water. Without your knowing it, it might be a baptismal splash, and then your liberty as a free-range agnostic would be curtailed." "I thought you were too self-absorbed to notice my spiritual pathology," said Elphaba. "Now, boys, what have we got today?" Every time, Bach thought, would that Galinda were here. For the casual camaraderie that grew up among them during these weeks was so refreshing, a model of ease and even wit. Against convention, they had dropped the honorifics. They interrupted one another and laughed and felt bold and important because of the secrecy of their mission. Crope and Tibbet cared little about animals or the bands. They were both Emerald City boys, sons, respectively, of a tax collector and of a palace security adviser. But Elphaba's passionate belief in the work enlivened them. Bach himself grew more involved, too. He imagined Galinda drawing her chair up with them, losing her upper crust reserve, allowing her eyes to glow with a shared and secret purpose. "I thought I knew all the shapes of passion," Elphaba said one bright afternoon. "I mean, growing up with a Unionist minister for a father. You come to expect that theology is the fundament on which all other thought and belief is based. But, boys, this week, Dr. Delamond made some sort of a scientific breakthrough. I'm not sure what it was, but it involved manipulating lenses, a pair of them, so he could peer at bits of tissue that he had laid on a transparent glass and backlit by candlelight. He began to dictate, and he was so excited that he sang his findings. He composed arias out of what he was seeing, recitatives about structure, about color, about the basic shapes of organic life. He has a horrible sandpapery voice, as you might imagine, for a goat. But how he warbled! Tremolo on the annotations, vibrato on the interpretations, and sostenuto on the implications. Long, triumphant, open vowels of discovery. I was sure someone would hear. I sang with him. I read his notes back to him like a student of musical composition." The good doctor was emboldened by his findings, and he required that their digging become more and more focused. He did not want to announce any breakthroughs until he had figured out the most politically advantageous way to present them. Toward the end of the summer, the push was on to find Lurleenist and early Unionist disquisitions on how the animals and the animals had been created and differentiated. It's not a matter of uncovering a scientific theory by a pre-scientific company of Unionist monks or pagan priests and priestesses, explained Elphaba. But Dr. Dillamont wants to authenticate the way our ancestors thought about this. The wizard's right to impose unjust laws may be better challenged if we know how the old codgers explained it to themselves. It was an interesting exercise. In one form or another, we all know some of the origin myths that predate the Ozzyad, said Tibbet, throwing his blonde bangs back with a theatrical flourish. The most coherent one has our dear putative fairy queen Lurleen on a voyage. She was tired of travel in the air. She stopped and called from the desert sands a font of water hidden deep beneath the earth's dry dunes. The water obeyed in such abundance that the land of Oz in all its febrile variety sprang up almost instantly. Lurleen drank herself into a stupor and went for a long rest on the top of Mount Runcible. When she awoke, she relieved herself copiously, and this became the Gilliken River, running around the vast tracts of the great Gilliken Forest and squirting through the eastern edges of the Vincus, and coming to a stop at Restwater. The animals were terricolous, and thus of a lower order than Lurleen and her retinue. Don't look at me like that. I know what that word means. I looked it up. It means living on or near the ground. The animals had come into their being as rolled clots of earth dislodged from the exuberant plant growth. When Lurleen let loose, the animals thought the raging stream was a flood sent to drown their fresh new world, and they despaired of their existence. In a panic, they flung themselves into the torrent and attempted to swim through Lurleen's urine. Those who became intimidated and turned back remained animals, beasts of burden, slaughtered for flesh, hunted for fun, counted as profit, admired as innocent. Those who swam on and made it to the farther shore were given the gifts of consciousness and language. "What a gift, to be able to imagine your own death," muttered Crope. Thus, animals. Convention, as long ago as history can remember, divides the animals and animals. "Baptism by piss," said Elphaba. "Is that a subtle way both to explain the talents of animals and to denigrate them at the same time?" "And what of the animals who drowned?" asked Bok. "They must have been the real losers, or the martyrs. Or the ghosts who live underground now and stop up the water supply so the fields of Munchkin Land dry up today." They all laughed and had more tea brought to the table. "I've found some later scriptures with a more Unionist slant," Bok said. "They tell a story that I guess would be derived from the pagan narrative, but it has been cleaned up some. The flood, occurring sometime after creation and before the advent of humankind, wasn't a massive piss by Lurleen, but the sea of tears wept by the unnamed god on the god's only visit to Oz. The unnamed god perceived the sorrow that would overwhelm the land throughout time and bawled in pain. The whole of Oz was a mile deep in saltwater tides. The animals kept afloat by means of the odd log, the uprooted tree. Those who swallowed enough of the tears of the unnamed god were imbued with a fulsome sympathy for their kin, and they began to construct rafts from the flotsam. They saved their kind out of mercy, and from their kindness they became a new, sentient lot, the animals. Another kind of baptism from within," said Tibbet. "Ingestion, I like it." But what of the pleasure, Faith? Said Crope. Can a witch or a sorcerer take an animal, and, through a spell, create an animal? Well, that's the thing I've been looking into, said Elphaba. The pleasure-faithers, the p-faithers, say that if anything, Lurleen or the unnamed god, could have done it once, magic could do it again. They even hint that the original distinction between animals and animals was a Cumbric witch spell, so strong and enduring it has never worn off. This is dangerous propaganda, malice incarnate. No one knows if there is such a thing as a Cumbric witch, let alone if there ever was. Myself, I think it's a part of the Lurleenist cycle that's gotten detached and developed independently. Arrant nonsense. We have no proof that magic is so strong. We have no proof that God is so strong, interrupted Tibbet. Which strikes me as being as good an argument against God as it is against magic, said Elphaba. But never mind that. The point is, if it is an enduring Cumbric spell, centuries old, it may be reversible. Or it may be perceived to be reversible, which is just as bad. In the interim, while sorcerers are at work experimenting with charms and spells, the animals lose their rights one by one. Just slowly enough so that it's hard to see as a coherent political campaign. It's a dicey scenario, and one that Dr. Dillamond hasn't figured out. At this point, Elphaba hitched the burnous part of her cloak up over her head and disappeared into the shadows of its folds. What? Said Bok, but she put a finger to her lips. Crope and Tibbet, as if on cue, launched into some silly banter about their professional goals of being abducted by pirates of the desert and made to dance the fandango dressed only in slave shackles. Bok saw nothing amiss. A couple of clerks reading the racing forms, some genteel ladies with their lemonades and novellas, a TikTok creature buying coffee beans by the pound, a parody of an old professor figuring out some theorem by arranging and rearranging some sugar cubes along the edge of his butter knife. A few minutes later, Elphaba relaxed. That TikTok thing works at Crage Hall. I think it's called Grammatic. Usually it shadows Madame Morrible like a lovesick puppy. I don't think it saw me. But she was too jittery to continue the conversation, and after she made sure their next assignments were clear, the crew disbanded into the misty streets. 2 weeks before Briscoe Hall reconvened for the new semester, Averick returned from his home, the seat of the Margrave of Ten Meadows. He was bronzed with summer leisure and eager for fun. He mocked Bok for having struck up friendships with boys from Three Queens, and under other circumstances, Bok would probably have let his new alliance with Crope and Tibbet lapse. But they were all engaged in Dr. Dillamond's research now, and Bok just put up with Averick's taunting. Elphaba remarked one day that she had had a letter from Galinda, away with her friends on Lake George. Can you believe it? She proposed I take a coach and come visit for a weekend, said Elphaba. She must really be bored out of her mind with those society girls. But she's society herself. How could she be bored? Asked Bok. Don't ask me to explain the nuances of that circle, said Elphaba. But I suspect that our Miss Galinda isn't quite as society as she makes out. "Well, Elfie, when are you going?" asked Bok. "Never," said Elphaba. "This work is too important." "Let me see the letter." "I don't have it. Bring it to me." "What are you on about?" "Maybe she needs you. She always seems to need you." "She needs me?" Elphaba laughed, coarsely, loudly. "Well, I know you're besotted, and I feel somewhat responsible. I'll show you the letter next week, but I'm not going to go just to give you a vicarious thrill, Bok, friend or no friend." The next week, she unfolded the letter. My dear Miss Elphaba, I am bad to write to you by my hostess, the Mrs. Farnay of Farn Hall, and Chen Chen of the Minkus clan. We are having a lovely summer at Lake George. The air is calm and sweet, and all is as pleasant as anything. If you would like to visit us for 3 or 4 days before school begins, we know you have been hard at work all summer and so. A little change. If you would like to come, no need to write, if you would like to visit. Just arrive by coach at Neverdale, and come by foot, or hire a hansom cab. It's just a mile or two by the bridge. The house is dear, covered in roses and ivy. It's called the Caprice in the Pines. Who wouldn't love it here? I do hope you can come. I do very specially hope so, for reasons I dare not write. I cannot advise you as to chaperones, as Amma Clutch is already here, and so is Amma Clip and Amma Vimp. You can decide. We hope for long hours of amusing conversation. Ever your loving friend, Miss Galinda, of the Arduenas of the Upland. 33 High Summer, Midday, at Caprice in the Pines. "But you must go," Bach cried. "Look how she writes to you." "She writes like someone who doesn't write very often," Elphaba observed. "I do hope you can come," she says. "She needs you, Elfie. I insist that you go." "Oh, you do? Why don't you go, then?" said Elphaba. "I hardly can go without having been invited." "Well, that's easy enough. I'll write and tell her to invite you." Elphaba reached for a pencil in her pocket. "Don't patronize me, Miss Elphaba," said Bach sternly. "This must be taken seriously." "You are lovesick and deluded," said Elphaba. "And I don't like your retreating back to Miss Elphaba to punish me for disagreeing with you. Besides, I can't go. I have no chaperone." "I'll be your chaperone." "Ha! As if Madame Morrible would allow that." "Well, how about—" Bach tossed it around. "How about my friend Averick? He's the son of a Margrave. He's spotless by virtue of his station. Even Madame Morrible would quail before a Margrave's son." "Madame Morrible wouldn't quail before a hurricane. Besides, have you no concern for me? I don't feel like traveling with this Averick." "Elfie," said Bach, "you owe me. I've been helping you out all summer, and I've had Crope and Tibbet helping, too. Now you have to pay me back. You ask Dr. Dillamond for a few days off, and I'll ask Averick, who is bursting to do something. The three of us will go to Lake George. Averick and I will rent a room in an inn, and we'll stay a very short time, just long enough to make sure that Miss Galinda is all right." "It's you I'm worried about, not her," said Elphaba, and Bach could see that he had won. Madame Morrible would not release Elphaba in the care of Averick. "Your dear father would never forgive me," she said, "but I am not the horrible Morrible you think of me. Oh, yes, I know your little pet names for me, Miss Elphaba. Amusing and juvenile. I am concerned for your welfare, and with all your hard work all summer, I see that you have grown, oh, shall we say, verdigrisian? So I shall make a compromise proposal. Provided that you can convince Master Averick and Master Bock to travel with you, and my own little Grammatic, whom I will loan in your care and to care for you, I shall permit your little summer fun." Elphaba, Bock, and Averick rode in the coach, and Grammatic was made to ride on top with the luggage. Elphaba met Bock's eyes from time to time, grimacing. But she ignored Averick, to whom she had taken an instant dislike. When he had finished with the pages of his racing form, Averick teased Bach about this trip. "I should have known when I left for the summer that you were mooning about in the throes of love. You developed this serious set of chin. It misled me. I thought it was consumption, at least. You should have come out with me that night before I left. A visit to the Philosophy Club would have been just what the doctor ordered. Bach was mortified to have such a dive mentioned in the presence of a female. But Elphaba seemed to take no notice. Perhaps she didn't know what it was. He tried to steer Averick away from the subject. "You don't know Miss Galinda, but you will find her charming," he said. "I guarantee that." "And she will probably find you charming," he thought, a bit late in the day. But he was even willing to live with that, if it was the price of helping Galinda out of a tricky situation. Averick was regarding Elphaba with contempt. "Miss Elphaba," he said formally, "does your name imply any elf blood in your background?" "What a novel idea," said Elphaba. "If there were, I suppose my limbs would be as brittle as uncooked pasta and come apart with the slightest of pressure. Would you care to apply some force?" She proffered a forearm, green as a spring limeberry. "Do, I beg you, so we can settle this question for once for all. We shall conclude that the relative force you need to break my arm, as opposed to other arms you have broken, is proportionate to the relative amount of human versus elfin blood in my veins." "I certainly will not touch you," said Averick, managing to say many things at once. "The elf in the self regrets," said Elphaba. "Were you to have dismembered me, I might have been posted back to Shiz in small pieces, and been spared the tedium of this forced holiday, and this company." "Oh, Elfie," Bach sighed, "this isn't a good start, you know." "I think it's swell," said Averick, glaring. "I didn't think friendship required this much," snapped Elphaba to Bach. "I was better off before." It was late afternoon by the time they arrived in Neverdale and settled at the inn, and made their way by foot along the lake to Caprice in the Pines. Two older women were in the sunlight by the portico, shelling string beans and wrist wrenches. The one Bach recognized was Amma Clutch, Galinda's chaperone. The other must be the minder of Miss Shenshen or Miss Fanet. They started at the sight of the procession coming up the drive, and Amma Clutch leaned forward, the string beans spilling out of her lap. "Well, I never," she said as they drew near. "It's Miss Elfie herself. My uncle's whiskers. I never did." She pulled herself to her feet and clasped Elphaba into her arms. Elphaba stood as stiff as a plaster figure. "Give us a minute to be catching our breath, duckies," said Amma Clutch. "Whatever in the blameless heaven are you doing here, Miss Elphaba? It don't seem possible." "I have been invited by Miss Galinda," said Elphaba, "and my fellow travellers here insisted they wanted to accompany me, so I find myself compelled to accept." "I know nothing of this," said Amma Clutch. "Miss Elphaba, let me take that heavy reticule and find you something clean to put on. You must be frayed from the voyage. You gentlemen will be staying in the village, of course, but for now the girls are in the summer house at the edge of the lake." The travellers made their way along a path interrupted with stone steps at the steeper parts. Grammatic took longer at steps and was left behind, and no one was inclined to stay and lend a hand to a figure with such a hard skin and clockwork thoughts. Skirting the final growth of holly-flight bushes, they came upon the gazebo. It was a skeleton house of unstripped logs, six sides open to the breezes, with a fretwork of arabesquing twigs, and Lake George a mighty field of blue beyond. The girls were sitting on steps and in wicker chairs, and Amma Clip was lost in some small work involving three needles and many colors of thread. "Miss Galinda," broke out Bach, needing his to be the first voice heard. The girls raised their heads. In evanescent summer frocks, free of hoops and bustles, they looked like birds about to scatter. "Holy terror," said Galinda, her jaw dropping. "What are you doing here?" "I'm not decent," shrieked Chen Chen, drawing attention to her unshod feet and pale, exposed ankles. Fane bit one corner of her lip and tried to revise her smirk into a smile of welcome. "I am not staying for long," said Elphaba. "By the way, girls, this is Master Averick, the Margrave descending from Ten Meadows, Gillikin. And this is Master Bok from Munchkinland. They're both at Briscoe Hall. Master Averick," as if you can't tell by the lovesick expression in Bok's face, "this is Miss Galinda of the Arduenas, and Miss Shen Shen and Miss Fane, who can outline their own pedigrees perfectly well." "But how enchanting, and how naughty," said Miss Shen Shen. "Miss Elphaba, who never gives us the time of day, you have redeemed yourself for all time by this pleasant surprise. How do you do, gentlemen?" "But," stammered Galinda, "but why are you here? What's wrong?" "I am here because I stupidly mentioned your invitation to Master Bok, who saw it as a sign from the unnamed god that we should visit." But at this, Miss Fane could control herself no longer, and fell on the floor of the gazebo, writhing in laughter. "What?" said Shen Shen. "What?" "But what invitation are you talking about?" asked Galinda. "I don't need to show you," said Elphaba. For the first time since Bok had known her, she looked confused. "Surely I don't need to bring it out." "I believe I have been set up to be mortified," said Galinda, glaring at the helpless Fane. "I am being humiliated for sport. This is not funny, Miss Fane. I have half a mind to kick you." Just then Gromatic made it around the edge of the holly-flight bush. The sight of the stupid copper thing teetering on the edge of a stone step made Shen Shen collapse against a column and join Fane in uncontrollable laughter. Even Amma Klip smiled to herself as she began to put away her materials. "But what is going on?" said Elphaba. "Were you born to plague me?" Galinda said tearfully to her roomie. "Did I ask for your association?" "Don't," said Bok. "Don't, Miss Galinda. Please don't say another word. You're upset." "I wrote the letter," heaved Fane between her gales of laughter. Averick began to chuckle, and Elphaba's eyes went wide and a little unfocused. "You mean you didn't write to invite me to visit here?" said Elphaba to Galinda. "Oh, dear, no, I did not," said Galinda. In her anger, she was beginning to regain some control, even though, Bok guessed, damage had been done for good. "My darling Miss Elphaba, I wouldn't have dreamed of exposing you to such thoughtless cruelties as these girls perpetrate on each other and on me for sheer amusement. Besides, you have no place in a setting like this." "But I have been invited," said Elphaba. "Miss Fane, you wrote that letter instead of Miss Galinda?"
"You ate it up," chortled Fane.
"Well, this is your home, and I accept your invitation, even if it was written under false pretenses," Elphaba said, her voice evenly matter-of-fact, as she stared into Miss Fane's narrowed eyes. "I'll go up and unpack my bags." She strode away. Only Gromatic followed. The air went stale with things unsaid. By and by, Fane's hysteria grew quieter, and she merely snorted and wheezed, and then grew still, lying vaporishly and unkempt on the flagstone floor of the gazebo.
"Well, you all needn't pierce me with your sniffy attitudes," she said at last. "It was a joke."
Elphaba stayed in her room for a day. Galinda came and went with a dinner. On occasion, she would stay for a few minutes. So the boys took to swimming and rowing on the lake with the girls. Bach tried to fan in himself an interest in Shen Shen or Fanet, who certainly were coquettish enough, but they both seemed besotted with Averick. At last, Bach cornered Galinda on the porch and pleaded with her to talk with him. She agreed, a measure of her demure demeanor returning, and they sat a short distance apart on a swing. "I suppose I'm to blame for not seeing through that ruse," said Bach. "Elfie wasn't inclined to accept that invitation. I made her."
"What is this Elfie?" said Galinda. "Where has propriety gone this summer, I ask you?"
"We've become friends."
"Well, I can promise to have gathered that. Why did you make her accept an invitation? Didn't you know I'd never write such a thing?"
"How should I know that? You're her roomie."
"By executive order of Madame Morrible, not by choice. I care to have that remembered."
"I didn't know. You seem to get along."
She sniffed and curled a lip, but it seemed to be a remark to herself.
Bach continued, "If you've been woefully humiliated, why don't you leave?"
"Perhaps I shall," she said. "I'm considering. Elphaba says that to leave is to admit defeat. Yet if she comes out of her hiding and begins to trip along with the rest of you, and me, the joke will be unbearable."
"They don't like her," she explained.
"Well, neither do you, I'd say," said Bach in an explosive whisper.
"It's different. I have a right and a reason," she retorted. "I am forced to put up with her. And all because my stupid Amma stepped on a rusty nail in the railway station in Frotica and missed the orientation. My whole academic career up in smoke because of my Amma's carelessness. When I'm a sorcerer, I'll have my revenge on her for that."
"You could say that Elphaba brought us together," said Bach softly. "I'm closer to her, and so I'm closer to you."
Galinda seemed to give up. She leaned her head back on the velvet cushions of the swing and said,
"Bach, you know, despite myself, I think you're a little sweet. You're a little sweet, and you're a little charming, and you're a little maddening, and you're a little habit-forming."
Bach held his breath.
"But you're little," she concluded. "You're a munchkin, for God's sake."
He kissed her. He kissed her. He kissed her, little by little by little.
The next day, Elphaba, Galinda, Bach, and Grammatik, and of course Amma Clutch, made the 6-hour trip back to Shiz with fewer than a dozen remarks among them. Averick stayed behind to disport himself with Fanet and Shen Shen. The pestering rain took up at the outskirts of Shiz, and the august facades of Craige Hall and Briscoe Hall were nearly obliterated with mist by the time they were, at last, home. Bach didn't have time or inclination to remark on his romance when he saw Crope and Tibbet. The Rhino librarian, having paid scant attention to the boys or their progress all summer, had suddenly cottoned on to how little had been achieved, and was all rheumatic huffs and watchful eyes. The boys chattered little. They brushed and cleaned vellum, and rubbed finfoot oil on leather bindings, and polished brass clasps. Only a few days left of this tedium. One afternoon,
Bok let his eye drift down the codex he was handling. Usually he worked without attention to the subject matter of the materials, but his eye was drawn to the bright red paint applied in the illustration. It was a picture, maybe 400-500 years old, of a Cumbric witch. Some monk's visionary zeal or anxiety about magic had inspired his brush. The witch stood on an isthmus connecting two rocky lands, and on either side of her stretched patches of cerulean blue sea with white-lipped waves of astonishing vigor and particularity. The witch held in her hands a beast of unrecognizable species, though it was clearly drowned or nearly drowned. She cradled it in an arm that, without attention to actual skeletal flexibility, lovingly encircled the beast's wet, spiky-furred back. With her other hand, she was freeing a breast from her robe, offering suck to the creature. Her expression was hard to read, or had the monk's hand smudged, or age and grime bestowed a sfumato sympathy. She was nearly motherly, with miserable child. Her look was inward or sad or something. But her feet didn't match her expression, for they were planted on the narrow strand with prehensile grip, apparent even through the silver-colored shoes whose coin-of-the-realm brilliance had first caught Bok's eye. Furthermore, the feet were turned out at 90-degree angles to the shins. They showed in profile as mirror images, heels clicked together and toes pointing in opposite directions, like a stance in ballet. The gown was a hazy dawn blue. He guessed by the jeweled tones of the work that the document hadn't been opened in centuries. Dramatically or teleologically, this image seemed some sort of a hybrid of the creation myths of the animals. Here were the floodwaters, whether they derived from legends of Lurline or the unnamed god, whether they were rising or sinking. Was the Cumbric witch interfering with or accomplishing the ordained fate of the beasts? Though in a script too crabbed and archaic for Bok to decipher, perhaps this document supported the fable of a Cumbric witch spell that gave the animals the gifts of speech, memory, and remorse. Perhaps it merely refuted it, but glowingly. Any way you looked at it, there was the syncretism of myth, myth's happy appetite to engorge on narrative strains. Maybe this painting was the suggestion of some alarmed monk that the animals received their strengths through yet another sort of baptism, by nursing at the teat of the Cumbric witch, inducted through the milk of the witch. Such analysis wasn't his strong point. He had a hard enough time with the nutrients and common pests of barley. He should do the unthinkable and deliver this actual scroll to Dr. Dillamond. It would be valuable to know about. Or maybe, he thought, as he hurried to meet Elphaba, the thing safely smuggled into the deep pocket of his cape and out of the Three Queens library. Maybe the witch wasn't feeding the drenched animal, but killing it, sacrificing it to stay the floods. Art was way beyond him. He had run into Amma Clutch in the bazaar and begged her to deliver a note to Elphaba. The good woman seemed more sympathetic than usual to him. Was Galinda singing his praises in the privacy of her room? It was his first time to see the funny green jumping bean since arriving back in Shiz. And there she was, on time, arriving at the café as requested, in a grey ghost of a dress, with a knitted overpull fraying at the sleeves, and a man's umbrella, big and black and lance-like when rolled up. Elphaba sat down with a graceless fromp and examined the scroll. She looked at it more closely than she would bring herself to look at Bok, but she listened to his exegesis and thought it feeble. What prevents this from being the Fairy Queen Lurline? she asked. "Well, the accoutrements of glamour are missing. I mean the golden nimbus of hair, the elegance, the transparent wings, the wand. Those silver shoes are pretty gaudy." She munched on a dry biscuit. "It doesn't look like a portrait of determination, or, what do I mean, genesis. It looks reactive rather than proactive. That figure is, at the very least, confused, don't you think? You've been hanging around Crope and Tibbet too long. Go back to your barley," she said, pocketing the thing. "You're getting vague and artsy. But I'll give it to Dr. Dillamond. I'll tell you, he keeps making breakthroughs. This business of opposing lenses has opened up a whole new world of corpuscular architecture. He let me look once, but I couldn't make out much except for stress and bias, color and pulse. He's very excited. The problem I see now is getting him to stop. I think he's on the verge of founding a whole new branch of knowledge, and every day's findings provoke 100 new questions. Clinical, theoretical, hypothetical, empirical, even ontological, I guess. He's been staying up late at night in the labs. We can see his lights on when we pull the drapes at night." "Well, does he need anything more from us? I have only 2 days left in that library, and then school starts." "I can't get him to focus. I think he's just putting together what he's got." "How about Galinda, then?" he said. "If we're done with academic espionage for the time being, how is she? Does she ask for me?" Elphaba allowed herself to look at Bok. "No. Galinda really hasn't said anything about you. To give you hope you don't deserve, I should add she's hardly said anything to me at all, either. She's in a heavy sulk." "When will I see her again?" "Does it mean that much to you?" She smiled wanly. "Bok, does she really mean that much to you?" "She is my world," he answered. "Your world is too small if she is it." "You can't criticize the size of a world. I can't help it, and I can't stop it, and I can't deny it." "I should say you look silly," she said, draining the last drops of lukewarm tea from her cup. "I should say you'll look back on this summer and cringe. She may be lovely, Bok. No, she is lovely, I agree. But you're worth a dozen of her." At his shocked expression, she threw up her hands. "Not to me. I don't mean me. Please, that stricken look, spare me." But he wasn't sure if he believed her. She gathered her things in a hurry and rushed out, knocking the spittoon over in a clatter, slicing her big umbrella right through someone's newspaper. She didn't look both ways as she lunged across Railway Square and was nearly mowed down by an old ox on a cumbersome tricycle. The next time Bok saw Elphaba and Galinda, all thoughts of romance fled. It was in the small triangular park outside the gate of Craige Hall. He had just been happening by once again, this time with Averick in tow. The gates had opened, and Amma Vimp had come flouncing out, face white and nose dripping, and a flurry of girls poured out after her. Among them were Elphaba and Galinda, and Shen Shen and Fene and Milla. Free of their walls, the girls huddled in chattering circles, or stood beneath the trees in shock, or hugged each other and wailed, and wiped each other's eyes. Bok and Averick hurried up to their friends. Elphaba had her shoulders high, like a cat's bony yoke, and hers was the only dry face. She stayed arm's length away from Galinda and the others. Bok longed to take Galinda in his arms, but she didn't look at him more than once before driving her face into Miller's tech fur collar. "What is it? What has happened?" said Averick. "Miss Shen Shen? Miss Fene?" "It's too horrible," they cried. and Galinda nodded, and her nose ran messily along the shoulder seam of Miller's blouse. "The police are there, and a doctor. But it seems to be..." "What?" said Bach, and turned to Elphaba. "Elfie,